The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Melanie Rudd is titled, Everything You Need to Know About Alopecia. The moment made an impression on everyone who was watching the 94th Annual Academy Awards ceremony this last April. Will Smith, nominated for Best Actor for his role in King Richard, approaching the Oscar stage to strike Chris Rock after the comedian made a joke about Jada Pinkett Smith's shaved head. The slap heard round the world, many are calling it. But the incident also spawned a larger conversation about an important topic, alopecia, or hair loss. Pinkett Smith has been open about the pressures of aging in Hollywood and her battle with alopecia, but Rock's joke clearly struck a nerve with her husband, who, in spite of their up-and-down relationship, rushed to her defense. Once the dust settled, many began to wonder, what exactly is alopecia? Ahead, top experts explain more about the condition, what causes it, who is most likely to be affected, and the treatments available. What is alopecia? Alopecia is a very broad medical term that simply means someone has hair loss, says Helena Kuhn, MD, assistant professor of dermatology and clinician educator at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Saying someone has alopecia is like saying someone has cancer. What type of cancer? In fact, there are several different kinds of alopecia, and understanding the nuances among them, particularly when it comes to treatment, is critical, Kuhn adds. In fact, there are more than 10 different types and even more subtypes of alopecia, notes Ifshan Chambers Harris, PhD, a trichologist and founder of Elodia Hair Care. These are the most common types of alopecia. Androgenic alopecia. This is the most prevalent form. Up to 95% of people experiencing hair loss suffer from androgenic alopecia, says Craig Ziering, MD, a board-certified dermatologist, hair restoration specialist, and transplant surgeon. You probably heard it called male or female pattern hair loss or baldness. In women, it manifests as thinning at the part. In men, as receding from the front or at the temples and at the top of the head. Alopecia areata. This is another common type and what many people think of when they hear the word alopecia, Kuhn points out. It's also what Pinkett Smith suffers from. The hair falls out in bizarre patterns, making the disease somewhat disfiguring, she says. There are four subtypes of this alopecia, adds Chambers Harris, who notes that it can vary from circular bald patches on the scalp to complete hair loss on the entire body. Telogen effluvium. This is stress-related hair shedding, characterized by sudden, extreme hair loss after a stressful event. It bears mentioning that some hair loss or shedding is normal for everyone. Ziering says most of us lose anywhere from 50 to 150 hairs per day, likely without giving it much thought. But in the case of telogen effluvium, this increases dramatically and typically starts 3 months after an emotional or physical stressor, adds Kuhn. Those who experience COVID-19-related hair shedding are thought to suffer from telogen effluvium. Traction alopecia. Unlike some of the other forms, which are caused by factors largely out of our control, more on this in a minute, traction alopecia is directly related to how we wear our hair. High-tension styles such as weaves and braid cause trauma to the follicles, leading to thinning and balding around the front of the hairline and around the temples, explains Chambers Harris. Central centrifugal sciatical alopecia. Most often referred to as CCCA, Chambers Harris notes that this is one of the more prevalent forms of scarring alopecia, meaning it destroys the follicles and the hair usually can't grow back. CCAA is characterized by permanent hair loss that starts centrally on the crown and extends outward, adds Kuhn. So what causes alopecia? Short answer, it depends on the type of alopecia in question. Androgenic alopecia has a hormonal component. It's caused by an excessive number of androgens that minimize the hair follicle and cause thinning, explains Chambers Harris. However, genetics and age also play a role. Alopecia areata is an autoimmune disease. Immune cells become confused and see the hair follicles as foreign and dangerous, attacking them and causing hair to fall out, explains Kuhn, who notes that what sets this off is still unknown. And as mentioned, telogen effluvium is triggered by emotional or physical stress. It shocks the follicles into entering the resting or telogen phase of the hair growth cycle, resulting in hair loss, says Ziering. Finally, physical damage to the hair follicle causes traction alopecia, while the CACC is multifactorial, a combination of genetics and harsh hair practices. How prevalent is alopecia and whom does it affect? This again depends on the specifics of the situation, but alopecia affects all genders, ages, and races. According to the Cleveland Clinic, androgenic alopecia affects 80 million Americans, and alopecia areata affects up to 6.8 million. For a little more context, by the age of 50, nearly 85% of men and 40% of women are experiencing some type of hair loss, notes Ziering. And while alopecia certainly isn't race-specific, there are particular types that are much more prevalent in African-American women than in any other group. To that point, what's the connection between race and alopecia? The Jada Pinkett Smith situation elicited both conversations about hair loss and how it affects African-American women specifically. Indeed, there are some direct connections. Approximately 50% of Black women report hair loss over their lifetime, says Kuhn, who adds that CCCA is the most common type for this group. Harsh hair care practices likely play a role. In a study conducted at Brown University by Yun-Young Cho, SCD, researchers found the lifetime incidence of alopecia areata to be significantly greater in Black and Hispanic females as compared to white females, and traction alopecia is also more common in African American and Latinx populations, says Kuhn, due to high tension hairstyles such as braids and weaves. What are the best treatments for alopecia? You have to know what type of alopecia you're dealing with to figure out the best possible treatment. For example, telogen effluvium typically resolves on its own. Once the stressor is removed or resolved, the shedding will eventually stop, usually after 3 to 6 months, and hair will regrow, says Kuhn. Treatments for male and female pattern hair loss run the gamut from everything from drugs such as finasteride and minoxidil, both in oral and topical form, to PRP injections, to laser therapy, to hair transplantation, says Ziering. Alopecia areata typically requires the use of topical and oral steroids, though both Chambers, Harris, and Kuhn note that a new class of medications known as JAK inhibitors is very promising and will hopefully be available to patients soon. CCCA treatments range from topical steroids to oral medications. Even though there are many nuances among the causes and treatments for all these varying types of alopecia, there are a few universal constants. First and foremost, early detection of any kind of alopecia is key to increasing the likelihood that treatment will work, advises Chambers Harris. Implementing good hair practices, avoiding those high-tension hairstyles, minimizing chemical treatments, using gentle products is always a good idea, she adds. And finally, all the things that are generally good for us, stress reduction, a healthy diet, a regular exercise routine, can also play a role in fighting hair loss and maintaining hair and scalp health, says Ziering. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, How to Get Over a Breakup According to Experts. There's no getting around it. Breakups are terrible, even if they're handled with compassion. They can shake you to your very foundations, causing you to question your confidence and your faith in love itself. If you've been broken up with, you're grappling with the very real pain of rejection on top of mourning a lost love. When you're the one who chose to end things, there's often guilt swirled into your sadness. Even in the most amicable, mutual situations, a split is an ending, and in a culture that emphasizes forever as a relationship goal, we're made to feel like an ending is a failure. In reality, breakups are often the shattering preamble to a new and improved life, one that can eventually include a relationship with someone you're more compatible with. But in those first few brutal days and weeks, you've got every right to feel inconsolable. In time, though, you can move onward and upward. Here are 20 ways to start feeling better fast, according to experts. Allow yourself time to grieve. No matter the circumstances of your split, your feelings are valid and processing them is a journey in itself. You're losing a big part of your life when you break up with someone. They are a friend, a lover, a confidant, and maybe a housemate, says Charlie Lester, dating expert and CMO of Lumen, a dating app for people over 50. They've probably been a daily feature in your life for some time, and you need to grieve that loss, almost like you would a death. Tess Brigham, a therapist and life coach based in California, agrees. It's okay to feel sad one day, mad the next, in denial the day after, and back to feeling sad again. Don't stay friends. Consider deleting your ex's number. Maybe the two of you said that you'd stay friends, as many people do. Dr. Gary W. Landowski, Jr., professor and former chair in the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University in New Jersey, explains that for some, keeping the connection helps things stay civil and makes the transition less abrupt, especially when you do it for practical reasons, like if you work together, but it can be a tough task. A post-breakup friendship may well happen in time, but time is the key word here. Very few exes make a seamless transition into friendship immediately. And if you think you've done it, see what happens when one of you starts dating someone new. Dr. Landowski, Jr. adds that staying friends with an ex is in fact linked to more depression, jealousy, heartbreak, and even a harder time finding a new romantic partner. If the breakup was instigated by the other person, delete their number from your phone so you aren't inclined to contact them, dating expert Lester says. It'll help you avoid the dreaded drunk dial and eliminate the impulse to send ill-advised texts. Protect your heart with a social media purge. Whether you're scrolling through old photos of happier times or hitting refresh on your ex's profile to analyze every update, Facebook and Instagram can be pure poison for the brokenhearted. Though it may be temporarily gratifying to satisfy your curiosity regarding what they're up to, Lewandowski Jr. suggests it's best not to look back. Trying to decode if your ex is happy when he or she posted a picture from brunch is just going to make you feel bad about yourself, says Brigham. No matter what an ego-wounded ex may tell you, it's not unkind to unfollow them. Feel free to block them in the name of mental health. You can also choose to snooze a Facebook friend for 30 days by clicking on the three dots in the right-hand corner of a status update, so they won't appear in your feed for a month. You'll still need the willpower to avoid checking their profile, though. The same goes for their friends and family, Lester suggests. If you think it's just going to make you obsess over your ex's every move, mute or remove them from your social media. In fact, Landowski Jr. explains that Facebook research participants who stalked their ex's profile more ended up having a harder time dealing with the breakup. Reports included nagging feelings of love, continued sexual desire, more distress and negative feelings, and less personal growth post-breakup, says the expert. Don't contact your ex unless absolutely necessary. Are you sensing a theme here? Distance is tough but crucial. Moving logistics and figuring out shared dog custody is one thing. Calling or dropping by to get that one sweatshirt you need is another. Do not drop by. It isn't going to help your healing process, and the quicker you can adjust to life without your ex in it, the better it's going to be for you, Lester explains. Don't go back to them. Let's be real. Rekindling a former flame can be tempting at times, even to the best of us. In feelings of weakness or a period of loneliness, one might find the idea of reconnecting with an ex more appealing than they should. Landowski Jr. illustrates how exes can be associated with a certain familiarity and convenience, which is why many people revert to going back to them. More specifically, those who need more reassurance and love in their relationships due to insecure attachment are more interested in getting back together with an ex. Instead of indulging, though, take charge of your healing journey and avoid prolonging it by calling up an old flame. Chances are you'll re-encounter the issues that drove you apart in the first place or erase all of your efforts to move on, especially if not enough time has passed. It's best to focus on yourself and redirect that energy to better things or potential new hobbies. Write on. A new activity you can pick up that'll help you move through your feelings during a breakup is writing. Breakups are inevitably filled with negative emotions, and it's all too easy to wallow in those feelings, spiral down and bottom out, explains Landowski Jr. To help get through this tough time, he recommends adopting this new hobby. For just 20 minutes a day over 3 days, commit to writing about your deepest thoughts and positive feelings regarding the former relationship. According to his research, participants that focused on the positive aspects reported a subsequent increase in positive emotions, including contentment, strong, thankful, relief, wise, and satisfaction. These participants evidently yielded better results than those who placed too much focus on the negative. Being a pessimist can taint your view on everything at times, but it can also allow feelings of anger, sadness, or resentment to build up and suffocate you from the inside. Existential psychotherapist Sarah Kuburek explains how completely dismissing a relationship that was once so meaningful to us does not honor our effort, our love, or the ways in which the person had enriched our lives. Recognizing the good and attributing meaning to the relationship can be healing, she says. It's important to be able to acknowledge the relationship in order to move forward and to see the good that can come out of it, like a possible silver lining. Schedule plans with friends. In the early days after a breakup, you're likely not going to feel great, so try to distract yourself as much as possible, says Lester. Make plans with friends so you don't have time to wallow. Book a dinner date with your best friend, and if it turns into an hours-long hang, all the better. If you're the type to neglect non-romantic relationships when you're in love, come armed with an apology and the intention to never do that again. You might throw your energy into forging new friendships, too. Before you dash off those invites, remember to strictly stick to buddies who make you feel like the best version of yourself instead of those who don't. Your heart is like a wounded baby animal right now, and it needs to be pampered. Lean into your experience. When faced with difficult feelings, many people opt for bottling them up in an attempt to avoid the pain associated with them. As much as you can distract yourself with fun activities, be careful not to box your feelings up completely. That backfires because trying to hold back your thoughts ironically encourages you to think about them more, explains Landowski Jr. His own research demonstrates that when people going through a breakup tried blocking out those feelings, they ended up feeling worse. Dr. Landowski Jr. tells us to embrace those inevitable feelings instead. Although it'll be painful, feel those feelings deeply and purposefully move through the waves of emotions that come with a relationship ending. Doing this will enable you to grow and move forward without awaiting for the feelings of distress you boxed up to eventually resurface. Make a breakup playlist. Music has a powerful effect on mood, which is why the breakup mix is a key part of your post-parting toolkit. When you find yourself adrift in a churning sea of emotion while driving to work or rage cleaning your apartment, let the breakup playlist be your constant. As for what to put on your mix, that's intensely personal. According to a 2016 study, listening to sad music is a source of comfort for some, while it makes others feel worse. If you know from past experience that moody songs will soothe you, go for it. Otherwise, you'll want to step away from that Adele album pronto. Consider energizing Talk to the Hand jams that make you feel, well, good as hell, to quote a Lizzo song. Truth Hurts is another excellent option. Reconstruct the future without them. During a relationship, it's inevitable to talk about your hopes and dreams and plan out what your future together might look like. According to Kuburek, this is one reason why we often feel stuck and lost after a breakup. The future we once envisioned, we can no longer have. If we don't handle these troubled waters correctly, though, we could fall into the trap of adding a disproportionate value to our ex-partner, making it even harder to move on. Kuburek suggests the solution is to focus on taking charge of our own path and goals. What we can do is change the future we see for ourselves. The more we're able to look forward and accept that new vision without the person, the closer we are to feeling healed. Rediscover yourself. Relationships often shape us, and breakups can shake us to our core. Kuburek explains how our sense of identity can get tangled up with our partner in the relationship, resulting in feelings of loss and confusion when it's over. Reflecting on who we are now that we no longer have the role of a partner or the influence of that person is an important step in moving on. She adds that it can help to do activities that help us reconnect with ourselves. In other words, return to the things you love doing, but they didn't. As Lewandowski Jr. describes in his TED Talk, breakups don't have to leave you broken. It's important to become reacquainted with parts of yourself that you may have de-emphasized or neglected during the relationship in order to remember who you are separate from the relationship. He encourages asking yourself what activities your relationship may have been blocking and then rediscovering that part of you. According to Lewandowski Jr., research participants who participated in rediscovery activities experienced more drastic benefits and overall positive feelings than participants who engaged in newer routine activities. Remember how Indian food used to be your favorite, but your ex nixed that takeout option every time? Order curry tonight and enjoy the taste of sweet freedom. Lose yourself in a good book. Is there a better and more affordable form of escapism than an absorbing read? Put one in your tote and head to the park or a coffee shop. It'll get you out of the house, and you never know who you'll strike up a conversation with about the page turner in your hands. Keep it and yourself moving with a new workout. Exercise helps your body get a shot of mood-lifting endorphins and serotonin. You can listen to that breakup playlist while you work out. And if you've never had a fitness regimen before now, that's okay. A recent study suggests that starting today can still yield major benefits, including a lower risk of heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and early death. Besides, it's difficult, if not impossible, to weep your way through an entire Zumba class. Travel and explore new places. Enter a new headspace by exploring a new location. It doesn't need to be a lavish, eat-pray-love-style solo trip either. Start by switching up your route home or check out a restaurant the two of you never went to. When you're in a relationship, it's easy to get stuck hanging out in the same places, doing the same things, Brigham points out. Push yourself to explore parts of the city you've never been in, or take a weekend trip by yourself to somewhere you've been meaning to visit but haven't had the time. Do not get a breakup haircut. Or at least wait a second before getting bangs for the first time in your adult life. Same goes for quitting your job, getting that tattoo that seemed brilliant last night, and all other major life changes. According to Lester, it's best to write these urges down and revisit them a few weeks later. Your emotions are likely to be running high, and you might not be sleeping or eating in a normal way, which can affect your judgment. Identify what you learned. When reflecting on your time with the person, figure out what the biggest takeaways are. Kaburik describes the importance of keeping the knowledge you've now acquired close to you, even if the relationship isn't. Relationships teach us a lot about the other person, but also about ourselves. She adds that the process of identifying what we've learned not only lets us find value in the relationship, but also prepares us as we move forward into the future. Having your lessons and thoughts clear following the closure of this chapter in your life can give you the tools you need to eventually enter your next relationship knowing what you want. Release the what-ifs and the mistakes. We learn a lot about ourselves through our relationships, both the good ones and the not-so-good ones, says Brigham. That said, going in circles and feeling angry and resentful isn't going to help you learn about yourself and what you want in a relationship. It's going to keep you stuck in the problems of the past. Resist that urge to obsess and fume over what went wrong. Kaburik explains the counterproductivity of dwelling on past mistakes or on hypotheticals, and the importance of accepting reality and forgiving ourselves, obviously depending on the situation. We cannot change the past, so let's accept this limitation and offer ourselves grace as we cope with it. Try to accept that the relationship ended for a reason and focus on picturing what you'd like to give and receive with your next partner instead. Meditation and therapy are two ways to let go of anger about the ways you were wronged, and definitely skip bringing the topic up on future dates. And speaking of dates, don't rush into the dating game too soon. If you do find yourself ranting about your last relationship while on a Tinder date, that's a clear sign that you need more time, Lester says. While meeting new people can be a great way to realize there are plenty more fish in the sea, you don't want to be sobbing about your ex over drinks, she adds. rethink your definition of closure. It isn't that there's no such thing as closure, it's that too many phone calls, DMs, and one last talk, coffee shop meetups are committed in the name of achieving it, when all you're actually doing is reopening a wound. True closure only comes with time. Lester breaks it down like this. In my experience, there are two scenarios. You either get enough time and emotional distance to be able to look back and appreciate why it didn't work, or you end up with an eclipse effect. That's when you meet someone else so amazing that they completely eclipse all your previous thoughts of your ex. Finally, when you're ready, forgive. Forgive yourself for mistakes you made in the relationship and forgive the other person, Brigham says. We don't forgive for the other person, we forgive for ourselves. Letting go of the bitterness will help you find that friendship with an ex eventually if you both want it. More importantly, it will help you move forward. Our next article by Kate Kelly is titled, We Need the Equal Rights Amendment Now More Than Ever. Let's Get It Passed. I sat on the floor surrounded by piles of various size scrapbooks. Some just contained photos, others held paper mementos and scalloped borders cut with special scissors. I leafed through the pages hoping to complete my assignment for my two college courses on genealogy. Once I found what I was looking for, a black and white photo of my great-grandfather riding a bull in an Arizona rodeo, I had become too engrossed to stop rifling through. I kept thumbing through the stacks, landing on a scrapbook my grandma had made for my mom. It was yellowed and not as embellished as the more modern albums, but it had obviously been made with care. As I turned the pages, I came upon a curious item. It was a newsprint clipping of an article with my mom's byline that she had written when she was a college student. Punctilious with her words, she made a convincing case against the Equal Rights Amendment. The ERA, she warned, would not be the boon women hoped it would be and could have unintended consequences. She raised alarm bells about the amendment with a staid tone that made defeating equality seem uneventful, even logical. As I closed the scrapbook, I wondered why my mother, now a successful lawyer fighting for women and victims of abuse, had fought against an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would guarantee women equal rights. I was raised Mormon. In my family, my mother and my grandmother were recruited by male leaders in our church to oppose the ERA and be the public faces of the amendment's opposition. In 1976, at the peak of the scramble for ERA state ratifications, the Mormon prophet issued a statement that instructed church members to fight the ERA with all they had. With those marching orders directly from God to defeat it, Mormon women enlisted throughout the United States in the anti-ERA battle. Of course, they had to do a bit of what Mormons call lying for the Lord. They said the ERA would erase gender and destroy the family. It wouldn't. They said it could force women onto the front lines of war. It couldn't. And they insisted it would hurt women to have legal equality, the biggest lie of all. Groups of Mormon women, organized by and with marching orders from men, infiltrated feminist state conventions by the droves to tank their platforms for equal rights. Men used walkie-talkies to direct the women inside how to vote and what to oppose from the parking lot. In Virginia, Mormons were less than 1% of the population, but produced 85% of the letters received by state legislators in opposition to the ERA. It failed there. In 1977, the ERA was defeated in Nevada. Almost half of the no votes in the Nevada Assembly came from legislators who had earlier pledged their support on the record, a complete betrayal. The National Organization for Women, or NOW, directly attributed the sudden change of heart to pressure on legislators from Mormon bishops. Thanks to a coalition of conservative groups, including Mormons, the ERA fell just three states short of ratification in 1982 when the initial time limit for ratification expired. It died an unceremonious death, and my family had helped to bury it. Women around the country mourned. When I followed in my mom's footsteps and went to law school in 2009, I learned that women still weren't included in the U.S. Constitution. This made me question everything. I learned that the level of judicial review for women as a class was lower than discrimination on the basis of race, religion, or national origin. When you take a discrimination case to court on those other grounds, you have a 73% chance of success. But discrimination on the basis of sex has only a 47% of success. Without the ERA, there are many laws to protect women that Congress can't pass. For example, the private remedy under the Violence Against Women's Act, where victims can sue their attackers, was struck down as unconstitutional. The ERA would fix that. I was horrified that the lasting legacy of being left out of the Constitution was still negatively impacting American women today. As opposed to my mom and my grandma, I chose to advocate for the ERA. I helped restart the group Mormons for ERA, an organization Sonia Johnson founded when I was a toddler. Whether your grandmother marched in the streets in support of the ERA in the 1970s, or worked alongside Stop ERA ringleader Phyllis Schlafly to battle against it, today's ERA is not your grandmother's ERA. Yes, I did say today's ERA. Despite all that praying and politicking from Mormon women like my grandma Carol, the ERA did not disappear in 1982 when the initial clock on ratification ran out. ERA diehards never gave up the fight and plotted to bring it back to life after all those decades. They tried to pick up the momentum from where it had petered out and drum up support in the final three states needed to get the ERA across the finish line in the modern day. In 2017, 40 years after it was defeated in Nevada by the Mormons, the ERA was finally resurrected by a black lesbian preacher in the Silver State. Senator Pat Spearman, having served in the military for 30 years, was ready for battle. Some derided her bill to ratify the ERA as a stunt, or at best as purely symbolic. Senator Spearman, looking dapper in her signature three-piece suit, rose to the Senate floor in Nevada and said the flag we all salute, or the wedding rings worn by many of those in the chamber, were also symbols. So even if the ERA is just a symbol, she said, it's still necessary because it's a very powerful symbol. And just like that, the battle for the ERA was reignited across the country. Senator Spearman got it ratified in Nevada. Illinois ratified in 2018, and Virginia sealed the deal as the 38th and final state needed to ratify in 2020. What was previously thought impossible was complete, a modern equality miracle, and it's not coming a moment too late. Today, gender equality is under attack on all fronts. Gains we thought we had definitely won decades ago are now suddenly being completely annihilated. In order to not be constantly defending our rights and relitigating struggles of the past, we need a fundamental fix. A few weeks ago, I told my grandmother that I had written a book about the Equal Rights Amendment called Ordinary Equality. Grandma Carol is still a very orthodox Mormon, still hates Sonia Johnson, and is still not a fan of the ERA, even after all these years. She immediately shot out a wry retort. So, it will be an unfinished book then? There's a kernel of truth to her savage wit. Despite all the work of women over the last century to fight our way to equal citizenship, and having met all the requirements of the amending process, we're still not across the finish line. The ERA has not made it into the Constitution where it belongs. If there's ever a scrapbook made of the fight for the ERA, it's not too late for you to make your mark as a part of it. Here's an excerpt from Kate Kelly's book, Ordinary Equality. In the late 70s, it was a race against the clock to get the final three states to ratify the ERA, and Mormons and other conservative groups were fighting hard to kill it. The Mormon prophet and his two counselors wrote an official statement against the ERA in 1976 and repeated it in 1978 in reaffirmation of the first presidency's position on the ERA, in case anyone missed the anti-equality memo from God the first time around. Church leaders at the highest levels officially opposed the amendment. Sonia Johnson was a devout Mormon and lived in Virginia when the reaffirmation letter was circulated to local church members. She obediently sat down to read the amendment, expecting to be convinced of its evils and toe the party line just as she had her whole life. But when she read the ERA, she unexpectedly disagreed with the church, saying, "I loved it. I just loved it." That was the start of her nationwide quest to get the amendment ratified. Sonia started the group Mormons for ERA with some of her Mormon lady friends in 1978. The group made Sonia the president and spokeswoman, and she was asked to testify at a Senate hearing in favor of the amendment in order to irk its main opponent in the Senate, Orrin Hatch of Utah. During the hearing, Senator Hatch became so visibly upset while questioning Sonia that his rage attracted media attention. Despite his obvious loathing, Sonia continued unruffled and eloquently voiced the sentiments of thousands of Mormon women who, like my mom and my grandma, didn't dare speak in favor of the ERA because they had been pressured and intimidated by the church. Kicking off with a showdown against a powerful senator was the start of many bold actions for Mormons for ERA. They marched down Pennsylvania Avenue with thousands of others in support of ratification. They chained themselves to Mormon temple gates to protest Mormon leadership's political involvement in opposing the ERA. In July 1979, they flew a private airplane towing a huge banner that read "Raise the Flag for ERA" in the sky over the Mormon temple in Washington, D.C., because they knew the wildly conservative Mormon prophet was going to be there for a flag ceremony. These church ladies were not messing around. They were radicalized and ready to rock and roll for equality. As a result of her activism, Sonia was hauled into a church disciplinary court. Thousands rallied to support her, including secular groups like the National Women's Political Caucus and the National Organization for Women. She had 5 witnesses testify in her defense at her trial, and hundreds sent in letters of support. But in the end, the Mormon men sitting in judgment over Sonia were unpersuadable, and she was convicted of apostasy, or defying church leadership, and cast out of her community, in their minds for all eternity. They condemned her to their version of spiritual death for advocating for gender equality. Also included in the article are the top 5 reasons to support the ERA in 2022. Number 1, the ERA will help save abortion rights. Number 2, the ERA will protect all marginalized genders, including transgender people who are under attack. Number 3, the ERA will help achieve equal pay for equal work. Number 4, the ERA will increase protections against gender-based violence. And number 5, the ERA is a permanent guarantee of equality, not subject to the whims of who is in Congress or the White House or on the Supreme Court. Our next article by Melanie Curry is titled, "What This Is Us Taught Me About My Sibling Relationship." The first time I watched This Is Us, I hated it. This is not surprising, considering most family dramas bore me. They are unrealistic, unrelatable, and cringy, and let's not get started on the lack of diversity. Parenthood and Modern Family were the exceptions, of course, but feel-good television shows are a dime a dozen. I'd rather stick to fantasy and sci-fi, thank you very much. But then the pandemic happened. I needed a new show to stream that wasn't about illegal tigers or a drug-addicted chess prodigy. Cue This Is Us. The This Is Us pilot nearly confirmed my initial thoughts. The NBC series follows the life of the Pearson family, Rebecca, Jack, and their 3 children, Kevin, Randall, and Kate, through past and present events. Nothing screamed original about this show. Rather, it read like a knockoff copy of Parenthood and Modern Family combined. And then I watched the second episode. Halfway into the episode, there's a scene where Rebecca is tucking Kate into bed when she hears Kevin and Randall fighting in the next room. "You shut up, Webster," Kevin says. "Stop calling me names," Randall retorts. Rebecca runs into their rooms and tries to calm them down. She knows Kevin is the culprit. We found out later that most of their arguments are started by Kevin, so she asks the 8-year-old, "Why are you always so hard on him?" His answer? "Everyone thinks it's weird that we're brothers," Kevin says. Randall is the adopted black child in the white Pearson family back in the 1980s. But what This Is Us showed wasn't the abnormality of white parents raising a black child, but the difficulty and loneliness a black child felt growing up around white people. Because even though Rebecca, with her good motherly intentions, told Kevin to leave Randall alone, she didn't talk about how Randall is black and he needs protection. Instead, she redirected the responsibility to Randall and kindly asked him if he'll try to get along with his brother. Flash forward 30-something years later, and we see the impact these micro-events had on Randall, Kevin, Rebecca, and their relationship to each other. Just from seeing this small 5-minute scene, I was hooked. Unlike its predecessors, Parenthood or Friday Night Lights, This Is Us wasn't only about the sad moments. It celebrated the small wins, such as having family dinners, saying goodnight to one another, or having a good laugh that we, as everyday people, seem to forget or take for granted. The show was pure, light, dramatic, serious, and funny. Few shows can balance hard, heavy topics like fat phobia and interracial adoption, while also presenting the joys of childhood, motherhood, and family. But This Is Us made it seem effortless. It didn't read as trauma porn or an emotionally manipulative series, to presume thoughts I once believed. It did make me cry, yes, but it also made me grin and gave me those stomach-hurting, tear-inducing laughs. Most importantly, what This Is Us does so well is that it accurately captures humanity. I might not agree with the choices my favorite characters make, but isn't that the point? The characters are not relatable to viewers because they have similar backgrounds or features, but because they're just like us. They hurt people, lash out, scream, cry, laugh, grieve, and smile. Too often family dramas forget the messy side of family, where you love and hate each other, or where you hurt one another even when you didn't mean to. Families are messy and flawed because we as humans are messy and flawed. Kate, Kevin, and Randall, the Pearson siblings, and the show's central characters, are on a perpetual journey of healing and progress as we all are. Maybe that's why my relationship with my own sibling has improved as I've watched This Is Us. Seeing Kevin and Randall fight, scream, and yell hurtful words to one another on screen was reminiscent of my childhood, where my twin and I engaged in the same behaviors. Like Randall, I saw my sibling as selfish, aggressive, and a bully. But what both Randall and I failed to see was the pain our siblings were experiencing at the time and their desperate cries for attention. I think back to a specific scene in season 6 where Randall and Kevin mend their feud. There wasn't a memorable word either character said that stuck with me, but rather the silent acceptance of each other. Kevin and Randall had hurt each other, and while Kevin's apology wasn't the most sincere, Randall stood his ground, and that was it. Kevin didn't magically become a better person, nor did Randall, but the two learned how to accept each other. My sister is not perfect. She can be mean at times, but she's also loyal and funny. We, like Kevin and Randall, may never have the closest relationship, but we're still family, flaws and all. This Is Us held up a mirror to our faces and show us the ugliest and most beautiful version of ourselves, which is why the show is one of a kind. Sure, you have other family dramas like Succession or Virgin River, but neither can compare to the NBC series because they lack relatability and humanity. So while the show may have ended after 7 incredible seasons, This Is Us is that heartfelt tearjerker emotional roller coaster that will have a hold on you no matter how many times you've rewatched. And honestly, we need that right now. From the Ukraine crisis to the overturning of Roe v. Wade, recent events have been difficult to process. It's hard to catch up emotionally and mentally, but that's why This Is Us and other dramatic shows are needed. Yes, they give us a good cry, but they also teach us empathy, pain, and sensitivity. I learned to empathize with my sister and her struggles after watching Kevin and Randall. I reframed my understanding of addiction after watching Kevin's journey with alcoholism. And perhaps most importantly, I've learned how to love myself, which echoes Kate's journey on the show. Now that we say farewell to This Is Us, the show's life lessons won't stop when the credits roll. They live on. Because as the show's title says, this is us, and there's no end to our story. Our next article by Leslie Mack is titled, What Happened in Buffalo is Not a One-Off Tragedy. Buffalo, New York is the 6th most segregated city in the country. In May, a white supremacist drove 4 hours to kill black people in Buffalo. The location of this massacre was Tops on Jefferson, the lone grocery store in what is otherwise the food desert of East Buffalo. It is a black-owned grocery store in the blackest part of Buffalo, a grocery store this community fought and organized to get for decades. Residents of East Buffalo called for a full grocery store for more than a decade before Tops opened, going as far as to contact executives from the grocery chain to ask them to open a store in their area. Tops is more than a grocery store to the residents of the east side of Buffalo. It is a community-rooted space. It is a place where black Buffalo found their needs being met. You can get to Tops by bus. You can pay your utility bills there. You can cash checks there. You can get a money order. In this place, the community felt safe, nurtured, connected, and loved. Saturday is the day after SNAP benefits were distributed and when folks, mostly black women, were doing their shopping for the week. It is when black elders were chatting next to the bakery section and little children were running around asking if they could get a candy bar. This is when a white man walked into the store intent on killing black people. These black victims, and I want to be clear that the victim designation should be appropriately applied to this entire community, were targeted in a place that is centered around community, a place they fought for to be able to meet their needs. This was a truly evil act. Buffalo native Takiya Nur Amin, who is a scholar and an educator, echoed the importance of community to the black residents in Buffalo when I spoke to her. What a lot of people don't understand is that black Buffalo residents have a lot of pride and dignity. We value our community deeply and are close-knit, even though the city has been under-resourced and taken advantage of in some ways for years. As I watch commentary from politicians on social media, on television, and in my personal group chats, I was struck by the short-sightedness of so many people. This tragedy is not a one-off act. It is the latest in a long line of violence and harm to the black people of Buffalo, and this murderer knew it. His rampage was planned and carried out specifically to harm not only the 10 souls who were killed, but also the overall stability, vitality, and mental health of black Buffalo and all black people. Again, Buffalo is the sixth most segregated city in the country. Let that sink in. The black community of Buffalo has been segregated since the first large groups of black folks arrived during the Great Migration, looking to escape the danger of the South and in search of jobs. Through racist zoning laws, restrictive covenants that allowed homeowners to stipulate homes could only be sold to other white people, and redlining, white lawmakers were able to create a hyper-segregated Buffalo that still exists today. Through this redlining, the city of Buffalo was able to restrict the ways that money could flow into and out of the black neighborhoods on the east side of Buffalo. The Federal Housing Authority's prevailing composition rule required public housing projects to be filled with people of the same race. That, coupled with an unwillingness of white communities to accept public housing in their neighborhoods, meant that all the public housing complexes built in Buffalo are on the black side of town. For more historical context, you should know that in 1957, the city of Buffalo created the Ellicott District Redevelopment Project. This project displaced 2,000 families, 80% of whom were black, and left them with little in return. Not long after, a highway was built through the heart of East Buffalo, further segregating the city. Buffalo is an Erie County. White people make up 76% of the Erie County population, but represent only 45% of the population of Buffalo. Conversely, black people make up 13% of the Erie County population, but 37% of Buffalo. Of all people who identify as black within the city of Buffalo, roughly 85% live east of Main Street. The life expectancy of white people on the west side of Main Street in Buffalo is 5 years higher than their black neighbors on the east side. Again, let that sink in. Moving just a few miles in Buffalo changes your life expectancy. This is the very definition of structural deliberate racism. This racism extends to employment opportunities. Job access is severely hampered by a lack of investment in public transportation, something that only 5% of white residents use versus 21% of black residents. Meanwhile, 58% of jobs in the area are not accessible by public transportation. Buffalo and black people in the United States mourn the losses and pray for the loved ones of Aaron Salter, Catherine Massey, Celestine Cheney, Roberta Drury, Pearl Young, Ruth Whitfield, Hayward Patterson, Margus D. Morrison, Andre McNeil, and Geraldine Talley. 9 out of the 10 victims were over 55 years old, elders of this community who carried with them a living history of black Buffalo, now gone. It's worth repeating over and over again. Buffalo is the sixth most segregated city in the country. It is time to address white supremacist violence, the kind that takes 10 lives in one afternoon, and the kind enacted through racist policies that has diminished the lives and opportunities of generations of black people. For those looking for a sign to get in this fight, here it is. The work is there to be picked up. Black communities know what we need. The question is, are you ready to listen and follow our lead to take meaningful action? Our next article by Nadine Jolie Courtney is titled, Signs You May Be in a Toxic Friendship. What a blessing friendship can be. Studies have suggested that those with really solid friends live longer. Like all deep relationships, however, even your platonic ones are bound to have their shaky moments. But if those tiffs or lingering feelings that you're not getting out as much as you're putting in happen more often than not, your friendship could be unhealthy or even toxic. Friendships can be protective and rewarding, nurturing and uplifting. If a friend has the opposite impact, we may want to reconsider our relationship and reconfigure that person's role in our lives. It doesn't mean you need to end the friendship altogether. Maybe you still see them for social gatherings, but they shouldn't be who you turn to for emotional support, explains Dr. Jessica Nicolisi, New York-based clinical psychologist and owner of Prana Wellness. Recognizing that you're in the midst of a toxic friendship by evaluating the signs is the first step toward extricating yourself, a painful but necessary process. As you get older, it's important to evaluate your friendships. If they're not healthy or serving a positive purpose, it's time to phase those people out, says Chris Perlmutter, author of Breakup Positive, noting that there's often fear and reluctance involved. We feel guilty about cutting people off. Maybe you've been friends since high school. But when we realize someone isn't supportive or an uplifting influence, you should reevaluate. Here are the telltale signs it might be time to say goodbye. They're jealous. Healthy competition between friends is normal and can even be positive, spurring you to be your best self while examining where you can improve. But when it crosses a line into jealousy, including aggressive competition, one-upping, and excessive attempts at leveling the playing field by diminishing your accomplishments, things become less kosher. Good friends are like cheerleaders. They root you on and take pride in your success. However, when jealousy interferes with a friend's ability to be supportive, it can have detrimental effects on the friendship, says Dr. Amanda Zaid, NYC-based licensed clinical psychologist. That's not to say that good friends won't have fleeting moments of jealousy. That's just life. But they work to contain those emotions and express them appropriately, rather than through veiled insults or overt competitiveness, explains Dr. Zaid. They make you feel insecure. If you're always walking away from them, feeling down on yourself or having to talk yourself into why that person is your friend, that person might not be right for you at this time, says Fadi Marie, California-based certified integrative holistic health coach at Encinitas' Four Moon Spa. Listen to your gut and start taking small steps back, away from any scenarios that might connect you to. While of course some friends are simply honest to a fault, which means you'll occasionally face negative reactions that are tough to stomach, those same straightforward pals will also prove equally supportive and consistently build you up. Dr. Nicolosi stresses the importance of paying attention to internal cues. Tune into your body. Do you feel weighed down, drained, and unsure of yourself? Listening to our inner voice is the best place to start. A sense of dread. If your friend's name popping up on your phone via text message or calendar appointment gives you a bad feeling, trust your intuition. That little pit in your stomach knows what's up. You shouldn't feel dread about seeing friends. If you do, ask yourself why, says motivational speaker and executive coach Colleen Elridge of Be More Consulting. You have to be careful around them. Does it always feel like you're walking on eggshells, afraid of saying or doing something that will make them fly off the handle? Classic sign. Close friendships involve valuing the thoughts and emotions of another person. If your friend becomes easily enraged and doesn't make an effort to see things from your perspective, you may want to consider whether the friendship feels healthy, says Dr. Zaid. They won't stop criticizing you. When a friend is always judging you, it can do a number on your self-esteem. Somebody who constantly belittles you and points out your flaws, we all have them, might not have your best interests at heart. It's important to draw boundaries and, as difficult as it can be, either stand up for yourself or back away. Toxic friends generally do not change, says psychotherapist and anger management specialist Tyra Gardner, author of Black Brilliance. What does change is how you treat them and whether or not you decide to keep these individuals in your life. All you do is talk about them. An important part of friendship is give and take. Sometimes you're going to need some extra TLC, and sometimes they will. But if your friendship is consistently lopsided and solely focused on their needs, and we're not talking about when they're going through a particularly tough chapter like divorce, there might be a problem. If you notice that you're always the one counseling, loaning, or saving in the relationship, then that friendship has the potential to be toxic, says Crystal D. Jordan, a relationship and women's issues writer. Sometimes gently pointing it out can help, as the friend might not recognize the issue. A simple thing that you can do is to say, "Right now I just need someone to listen to me," says Perlmutter. If the friend is capable of that, then keep them around. If not, well, you have a decision to make. They're energy vampires. Healthy relationships leave you feeling emotionally fulfilled, not so with toxic ones. You'll leave an interaction with a toxic friend feeling drained, Elridge says. This could be because of the drama they bring or because of the heavy lifting you have to do with them without any reciprocal support. Friendship should provide daily bouts of joy in your life. What a friendship should not bring into your life is stress, says Tammy Shackley, relationship expert and founder of H4M Matchmaking. It should not leave you feeling anxious, obsessed, or drained. Everything is always super dramatic. Of course, life is not without its ups and downs. It's only normal that drama will pop up. But if a friend seems to thrive on that drama and is constantly sucking you into it, it may be cause for concern. They keep trying to change you. It's a common scenario, that friend who just won't stop offering feedback about everything from your dating profile to your eyeshadow, leaving you feeling as if you're not good enough. It's often hidden under the guise of caring and concern, which can make the barrage of helpful advice that much more toxic. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.